Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, I'm Scott Lipkowitz, and you're listening to New Books in Military History, part of the New Books Network. Charles Lord Cornwallis's campaign through the Southern American colonies came to an ignominious close on October 19, 1781, on an open field outside Yorktown, Virginia. At approximately noon, Cornwallis's beleaguered soldiers emerged from behind their fortifications, laid down their arms, and delivered the Earl's sword to Continental General Benjamin Lincoln, a man whom Cornwallis had helped vanquish a little over a year before at the Siege of Charleston. This dramatic reversal of fortune closed the door on a once aggressive British stratagem designed to end the American rebellion by dismembering its southern limbs one by one. Initial victories at Augusta, Savannah, Charleston, and Camden appeared to augur well for Cornwallis's campaign. But what began with great promise in 1779 and 1780 soon ended in resounding defeat. After fighting Continental General Nathaniel Greene, Patriot partisans, and the Carolina backcountry throughout 1781, Cornwallis's army was a spent force. Besieged at Yorktown, with no hope for relief, the Earl was left with little choice but to surrender. Ever since, generals, historians, and popular culture have pilloried Cornwallis for his ostensibly inept handling of the Southern campaign, and have laid responsibility for quote-unquote losing America firmly at his feet. But was the Earl truly to blame? Was Britain's decision to move the seat of war to the southern colonies a sound strategy poorly executed, or simply a bad strategy? These questions form the analytical framework for Stanley D.M. Carpenter's masterful strategic study, Southern Gambit, Cornwallis and the British March to Yorktown, published by University of Oklahoma Press. Stanley Carpenter is a former U.S. Navy captain and recently retired command historian and professor of naval strategy and policy at the U.S. Naval War College. It is my great pleasure to welcome him to the show. Stan, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here, Scott.
Before we delve into the book, how did you come to write about the British Army and the American War for Independence, and Cornwallis in particular?
Well, this goes back to when I was very young, 10 or 11, I guess. My parents have always been interested in history, and my dad in particular, military history. He was a university professor, and his field was journalism and communications, not history, but he was an amateur military historian, if you will. And so we would go, my two younger brothers and I, we would go to every battlefield and battlefield park that we could. And growing up in North Carolina, of course, you had Civil War and War of American Independence battlefields all over the place in both the Carolinas, Tennessee, Virginia. So we visited a lot as a family. And I remember distinctly, it would have been the summer of 1963, maybe 64. We went to the Guilford Courthouse battlefield in Greensboro. And I remember that everyone was all enthralled with Nathaniel Greene. And those that don't know the story, essentially, this was the big battle that after Cornwallis chased Greene all the way through North Carolina and into Virginia. Greene came back in and was willing to commit to an actual battle. Cornwallis won the battle tactically in that he held the field, but it really allowed Greene to achieve his strategic intent, which was to attrite every time and they engaged the British forces. So it was a fascinating battle. And I remember everyone all gaga about Nathanael Greene, only I was intrigued by Lord Cornwallis. And I think that was probably the start of my fascination, not only with the War of American Independence, but specifically Lord Cornwallis. Also, there's a family relationship there. My ancestors on both sides were all loyalists. On my mother's side, they were the Scottish Highlanders from around Cross Creek, which is now Fayetteville area. And they were all about 95% loyalist. Then on my dad's side, my great-great-great-great-grandfather was a loyalist officer, wounded in action at the Battle of Ramsor's Mill in June of 1780, which ended his military career. But so there's that family association with the period, as well as with British military history. And it just sort of grew from there, and a more broadly general interest in British history. So when I was an undergraduate at University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, that was my focus, was British history in general, but more specifically British military history. And that's been my basically career path ever since.
Britain's objective in the American War, as our listeners probably know, was to put down the rebellion, pacify the colonies, and return them to allegiance. How did the Southern strategy, at least as it was initially conceived, work towards this end? And why did the British High Command decide to employ it in 1778?
Well, it didn't work, obviously. You have to look at the world situation as it evolved by 1778, because just after the Patriot victory at Saratoga, at that point, the French, who had been surreptitiously supplying arms and powder and uniforms and financial support, actually decided to come out and ally with the Continental Congress or the new United States against their age-old opponent, Great Britain. Now, France did not really care for revolutionaries. That was not why they were doing it. They were seeing it as an opportunity to exact some vengeance for their humiliating loss in the Seven Years' War, and hopefully gain back some of the colonies they'd been forced to give up to Britain with that settlement. So that changed the whole dynamic. Now Britain is fighting not only to put down a rebellion and restore allegiance, but now they have yet another world war, global maritime war on their hands against first the French. Then the Spanish come in on the French and American side in 1779. Then the Dutch come in 1780. And unlike previous wars against the French, the British didn't have any continental allies. And so now they're having to defend the empire and even defend the home islands. But, oh, by the way, put down this rebellion in the colony. So in 1778, they looked at where do we go? What can we salvage? The South was perceived to have a majority of loyalists just waiting for the British Army to show up and rise up. They had done so in 1776. That was the Highlanders, resulted in a disaster. And I think, in truth, they were right in that assumption that the majority of folks in the South at that time were loyalist or at least neutral and wanted to stay out of the fight. And so to take limited resources to try to win back at least as many of the colonies as possible, starting with Georgia, moving up through the Carolinas into Virginia, because those southern colonies, because of the agricultural commodities like tobacco and indigo and rice, and especially naval stores, timber, they were the most economically viable. So the idea was to win back the South and then, with minimal resources, relying on the loyalists to rise up after the army had defeated any Patriot forces, to restore royal government and also tamp down any Patriot activity. That was the strategic intent and the strategic concept. And therefore, they launched off in late 1778 on what's called the Loyalist Strategy or the Southern Strategy.
Modern strategic concepts like strategic coherence, strategic leadership, and theory of victory are foundational to the analytical framework you use. And I want to get into those concepts in a moment. But is it anachronistic to apply modern strategic concepts to 18th century warfare, especially when there's no command and control structure, you know, as we would understand it today?
No, it isn't. These are concepts that can be applied all the way back to when caveman A took a bone and decided to steal caveman B's cave. Because strategy is strategy. And if you look at it this way, every human action or interaction has levels, like in levels of war. There's a policy, which is the what you want to accomplish. There's the strategy, that's essentially your plan for going about accomplishing that objective or goal. There's the operation, which is you're actually conducting something in support of the strategy. And then there are the actual tactics, which is the caveman taking the bone and clubbing the guy on the head. And one of the things I've always done in my seminars in the very first meeting is make that point by this example. I'll point to a student who's brought in a coffee and I say, okay, let's play a game here. What was your policy objective? And usually they get it. Well, to stay awake in this boring seminar. Okay, so what's your strategy? To caffeinate. So what's your operation? To go to the 7-Eleven and buy the coffee. And what's your tactic? Actually drink it. And at that point, hopefully most students realize these are concepts, strategic concepts that have applied forever, regardless of whether it's linear warfare or irregular warfare or counterinsurgency. Strategic concepts and strategic thinking applies all the way through. So, yeah, you're right that you don't have the command and control and communications of 2020 in 1780-81, but the dynamic of having to communicate intent, strategic intent, control forces from a distance, all these dynamics are still there. It's just in a different modality, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that it's like studying Carl von Clausewitz. Yes, he wrote that over two centuries ago. But the reason why we still study Clausewitz or even Sun Tzu, who's over 2,500 years back, the reason is they capture essentials of conflict that have always existed. And so when you take it down to the next level and talk about things like strategic intent, strategic imperative, strategic communications, all these dynamics that go into strategy, they apply regardless of the age, regardless of the venue, regardless of the time frame, all these things still apply.
Yeah, I think it is interesting that when historians typically write about this and put forth that criticism, that they act almost as if having a general staff or some institutional structure that does what a general staff does somehow inoculates you from ego and personality. Right. And I think in every war since, the Franco-Prussian War, you see that's clearly not the case, that the structures, maybe they contain it better, but it's not really any different.
Yeah. And in a book that I did actually was originally based on my doctoral dissertation. It was Military Leadership in the British Civil Wars. And I looked at six major theater, what we would call today theater commanders, three parliamentarian and three royalists. And I came up with what I called my characteristics of effective military leadership, things like moral authority, risk-taking, all these human dynamics, and then took the six major commanders and racked and stacked them, if you will, to try to add to the explanation of why the parliamentary forces eventually prevailed. And of course, as you might imagine, the top three were all parliamentarians, the bottom three were royalist commanders. Well, these are dynamics that you can, I fully believe, can apply, whether it's Lord Cornwallis thrashing about in the Carolina backcountry, or whether it's chasing down the Taliban in Afghanistan. All these characteristics of warfare that have always existed, because there's a human context, are today here. They were in 1780 in the colonies, and they'll be here, I think, when we're doing Star Wars and Star Trek and whatever, same kind of thing happens.
that'll be fantastic. Lord Cornwallis in space. So one of the strategic concepts that looms large throughout the book is strategic coherence. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, what is strategic coherence and how did it manifest or fail to manifest, you know, in the British High Command throughout the campaign?
Yeah, the strategic coherence is basically whatever side you're on, you have an agreement among the major decision makers that this is the overall strategy we're going to pursue. And then it gets down to the next level of how are we going to actually pursue that strategy. That's your operational execution. And the problem for the British, when I talk about strategic incoherence, which I'm not sure that's an actual word, every time they, you know, the wordsmith thing pops up, but I love the word anyway, strategic incoherence. What you essentially had was the three nodes of the strategic triad, as I call it. That's Lord Cornwallis, actually in the field, Sir Henry Clinton, Commander-in-Chief in New York. And then in London, you had Lord George Germain, who was the American Secretary of State, who was overall responsible for prosecuting the war. Essentially, they were working off a different strategic concept or different strategic intent. And this was resulted in literally a breakdown in the command and control. You even had to the point of where Lord Cornwallis, the field commander, was completely bypassing his commander-in-chief in New York and communicating or corresponding directly with Lord Germain. Mm. And so that's what I mean by strategic incoherence. When you're not operating with the same strategic intent or same strategic concept, and bad things flow from that, particularly the operational execution breaks down. And that's what we see in the Southern campaign, I would say pretty much from the time that Sir Henry Clinton departed Charleston in June of 1780 after defeating Lincoln, capturing the city. Everything was hunky-dory to that point. Once he departed, Cornwallis was in charge, and then you start to see the breakdown in the British strategic coherence. Mm.
What was the theory of victory? Maybe you could go into explain that term as well a little bit. And what was the theory of victory when they first started operations, you know, in Georgia in 1779 at the start of the Southern campaign?
Right. Theory of victory. I don't know if this was original, but Professor Brad Leaves, Professor Emeritus from Naval War College, I don't know if he coined the term, but he certainly made it popular. Theory of victory is just simply those assumptions that you make that based on the strategy and operations that you're employing, this will happen. It will cause that to happen, which will cause this to happen. And it's almost like if you can visualize a cross, mm-hmm. crossing back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I'll do something. The enemy will respond and do something. I will then respond to that. So it's that set of assumptions as to what will happen once you put your strategy and operations into play. And so I would say the theory of victory for the Southern campaign was what I mentioned earlier, that once the army comes in, defeats any Continental Army forces in the South and any militia or patriot or rebel forces, once they're militarily defeated and the army moves on to its next target, that the local loyalists will then show up in huge numbers and restore royal government. Royalist militia, loyalist militias will put down and tamp down any militia activity on the part of the Patriots. And essentially, you're just one colony at a time moving up from Georgia, you're restoring allegiance. And remember now also that East Florida and West Florida were already heavily loyalist. So you would start in Georgia and move up probably as far as Maryland. I don't think they planned on going any further north than that. But that was the theory of victory.
You mentioned, you know, having loyalist support, and it seems, you know, you stressed throughout the book, as you just said, that they base the campaign on this perception that there's an endless wellspring of loyalist support that they'll be able to continuously draw from as the campaign unfolds. Was this the case? And if not, you know, what indications prior to the commencement of the campaign were, you know, Clinton, Cornwallis, and Germain reading that gave them this impression?
Well, there were a couple of things. I mentioned earlier the loyalists, North Carolina loyalists, were badly beaten at Morris Creek Bridge, which, by the way, one of my ancestors was killed leading a broadsword charge across that bridge. That was February of 1776. And literally within a matter of days or weeks, well over 1,000 Loyalists were raised in that Cross Creek area, and they were marching down to join the army that was supposed to land in Wilmington to commence operations. Well, they were badly beaten, ambushed and badly beaten at Morris Creek Bridge. But looking at that, well, here's an indicator that there's a lot of Loyalist support there, and they're just waiting for the army to arrive. Then the royal governors of Georgia and South Carolina, both were in exile, of course, were sending letters back to London saying, all it takes is the army to arrive and the population will rise up against the rebels. And more specifically, a fellow by the name of Simpson, James Simpson, who was the former attorney general for colony South Carolina, he was specifically tasked by Lord Germain, the American secretary, to assess Loyalists' intent. And he wrote back that once His Majesty's forces arrive, then the population will rise up. So you've got all these indicators of a lot of Loyalism. And I think really there probably were a majority of Loyalist, or at least Loyalist leaning folks in the South as opposed to the Middle and the New England colony. So in that regard, the assumption was probably pretty valid. Here's the problem. You had a couple of events that really tamped down Loyalism in the Carolinas. One was Battle of Ramseur's Mill, which I mentioned earlier, where about 1,300 Western North Carolina Loyalists were gathering to march into South Carolina to join the army. They were attacked at Ramseur's Mill, which is now about 35 miles west of Charlotte, and badly beaten. And this had a real dampening effect, if you will, on the enthusiasm of Western North Carolina Loyalists. Then you had Kings Mountain in October. Those were some North Carolina Loyalists, an awful lot of South Carolina Loyalists from particularly around the 96 area. Well, those of us who know the story of Kings Mountain, that was a disaster. So military defeats like that really tamped down the Loyalist enthusiasm. Then the activities of folks like Francis Marion and Sumter, who would win a few, lose a few, but I think largely on balance, they won more than they lost. And so all these attacks on Loyalists, and finally you get the point where someone says, hey, I really support the king. I would love to be back in good old Britain, but I got to watch out for my family. They hanged my brother yesterday. You know, you get all these human dynamics. And so finally, when Cornwallis, after the Guilford Courthouse, retreated back to Hillsborough, put out this magnificent proclamation. Everybody show up. And it's something like 100 or so showed up. Most of them waved, said, hi, nice to have you. And then they went home. And at that point, you could actually see in Lord Cornwallis's correspondence where he's basically decided that that's an empty vessel, that they're not going to really get any Loyalist turnout. But I think ultimately, when you get back to the whole theory of victory, the theory, the assumption could have been valid had actual operational events gone. Let's say Kings Mountain hadn't happened. Let's say the Loyalists had won over the Patriots at Ramseur's Mill. These sorts of things changed the dynamic and made the assumptions, well, as they say with assumptions, assuming things make an ass of you and me. So yeah. That's what happened.
At the same time that those events are going on, though, it also seems that at least the conventional aspects, you know, to what you described, you know, as the hybrid warfare, seem to be working. You know, they capture Augusta, they capture Savannah, they defeat Benjamin Lincoln at Charlestown. But then this other dynamic is created when Clinton issues the May 22nd and June 3rd, 1780 loyalty proclamations. Did it also suppress the Loyalist turnout?
Yeah, it had a dampening effect in this regard. The intent of the proclamation, I think, was two parts. The first intent was to basically tell all the paroled Continental Army troops from Charleston, hey, you've lost, no more fighting for the Patriots. And oh, by the way, you now can't remain neutral. You have to actively support the restoration of royal authority. That was one aspect. And what that did, of course, was if you're faced with, okay, if I don't actually come out in support of the crown and actively engage on behalf of the crown, I'm still in treason. So I might as well do what I want to do and join Francis Marion or flee to North Carolina and rejoin the Continental Army. So that was one dynamic. The other dynamic was it really agitated the loyalists who had been suffering under, quite frankly, a lot of oppression for the previous 4 years because the Patriots had taken control of all the levers of law and government in all the southern colonies. So now all of a sudden the army has come. We've crushed the Continental Army. They're on the run. And now you're going to allow them to parole. You're not going to punish them, which was part of the proclamation. And so at that point, perhaps a lot of loyalists said, why do I bother? I'm just going to go home and remain neutral. And so I think, although you can't really quantify that, there are a few letters that indicate that from various prominent loyalists. But I suspect, again, a human dynamic. Why am I suffering? Why did I put out if they're going to allow these people to go free, to not be punished, to allow them to go on parole? So really, the proclamations, I think, had two impacts, one on the Patriots and one on the loyalists.
Despite the partisan violence that erupts after the proclamations, Cornwallis is able to defeat a second Continental Army under Horatio Gates at the Battle of Camden. And, you know, this would seem to vindicate a conventional approach that even despite losing the loyalists, you're still essentially the campaign is a success because you are defeating the Continentals in the field. But in the book, you characterize Camden as a Pyrrhic victory. Why do you see it that way?
It was, as a battlefield victory, the most thorough thrashing of the Continentals of the entire war. A lot of that has to do with the skill of Cornwallis himself, of his subordinate commanders like Lord Rowden. The troops that he had were superb, which is not to belittle the Continental Army troops on Gates' side, but Gates made some huge errors. One of them, since most of his army was actually militia, we all know the problems with militia, especially when they come up against trained veteran soldiers. And Gates made the tactical error of putting the North Carolina and Virginia militia on his left flank, which, of course, meant they came up against the boys of the 33rd, the 71st, the 23rd, the regular regiments. And I think that was a foregone conclusion. Where that was a problem and why it was a Pyrrhic victory, it validated, as you've just mentioned, it validated in Cornwallis and every other British officer's mind, this is the way to win. We crush every opposition that pops up, and we're accomplishing the mission. We're accomplishing the strategic intent, because as the locals see what's happening, the loyalists will come in and support us, the neutrals will stay neutral, and the rebels will probably try to run to the hills and hide, and you've accomplished your mission. So it was a Pyrrhic victory in the sense that tactically, Cornwallis won big, but strategically overall, what it did was it validated a false assumption, and it also meant that now you had the rise of the insurgents, because with no more Continental Army forces in South Carolina, folks like Francis Marion and Pickens and Pinckney and the various groups adopted that insurgency, that guerrilla warfare, if you will. And that ultimately is what cost the British South Carolina in 1781, was the inability to put down those partisan groups, the insurgents. So Camden had that double effect. It had the effect of validating what was ultimately a false assumption on the part of the British, and it also led to the rise of the partisans and the irregular warfare.
I guess that actually would kind of belie. I was gonna ask you a question about you know, did it make sense actually to go after the army in such a way? You know, once you get to the race in the Dan, which I was going to talk about a little later, but once you get to the race in the Dan, does it actually make strategic sense? Because, you know, at least in the historiography, you get the sense, you know, especially from Washington's kind of hesitance or reticence to engage in open combat with Clinton, you know, he and other revolutionary leaders, at least in the military, are palpably aware that, you know, the army is the nation. But this would actually suggest that even if you had, you know, wiped out all the Continental armies in the South, you're just kind of like hydraulically pushing in one spot. And now you're popping up in all these other areas, which I guess is a, you know, one of the issues when an insurgency, you know, we don't usually think of the American Revolution as an insurgency, but in, you know, in reality, that's what it was.
Right. And that's the term hybrid, which is, it's a fairly recent term. I think Williamson Murray in one of his books started talking about it. And that just basically is a combination of warfare with irregular and conventional regular elements all working together. And that's exactly what happened in the South. You had the conventional struggle between the Continental Army and the British forces, and then you had the irregular war going on, which was between the partisans of both sides.
Another strategic concept that runs throughout the book is the idea that the enemy always has a seat at your strategic table. So I thought that, you know, we could talk a little bit about Cornwallis's nemesis, General Nathanael Greene. Who was he, and why was he a more formidable opponent than any other Continental Army general that that Cornwallis had met up until that point?
Well, let me tell you a story about Nathanael Greene. Since I have lived in Rhode Island the last 22 years, he's sort of a local hero done good. He was not a soldier with any experience, but he was extremely well-read in military history and very much interested in it. And he was one of the founding members of a militia unit here called the Kentish Guards. And they were actually very good, very well trained, very well drilled. But Nathanael Greene walked with a limp. I think he'd been thrown off a horse or some accident, but a slight limp. So here you have these very proud militiamen looking like real soldiers. And here's Private Nathanael Greene trailing along behind, dragging his bum foot. So they actually tried to vote him off the island, if you will. that was 1774. But it's good to have friends in high places, because 1 year later, he is a brigadier general in command of all the Rhode Island forces in the Army of Observation, which was the name of the Continental Army around Boston as they hemmed in General Gage's forces. So to go from private to brigadier, it's pretty good.
Yeah,
but he had good political connections. Well, he was then promoted to major general, an excellent choice, because I contend that while someone like Benedict Arnold was probably tactically the best general, at least initially, on the Patriot side, strategically, Nathanael Greene, I think, was the most brilliant and successful. And it was a good choice. Once Gates was defeated at Camden and oh, by the way, hopped on his horse, ironically named Fear Not, and didn't stop until he reached Charlotte, 65 miles away, fleeing from the battlefield. Well, Washington appointed Greene, who had been a superb quartermaster general and really kept the army alive at Valley Forge. Greene was a businessman, his family owned a lot of businesses in Rhode Island. So he had that business background. He was able to, as quartermaster general, even though he hated it, he wanted to be in the field commanding troops. He did a superior job. So Washington appointed him after Camden to go down and take over as commander of the Southern Department. Here's where Greene was strategically brilliant, because he realized that the way to defeat Cornwallis was to cause a merry chase, if you will, to force Cornwallis to chase him. And every day that Cornwallis was in the field, he lost more men. The more you could pull him into the interior, away from the sources of supply and reinforcement to the Royal Navy along the coast, that was something Cornwallis couldn't replace. And so it's a classic protraction and attrition or Fabian strategy. And then, of course, with the Fabian strategy, you have to have a culminating conventional battle defeat. Well, that was Guilford Courthouse. Didn't turn out quite that way, but certainly Yorktown a few months later did. And so I think Greene was not that good tactically. He lost practically every time he went into the field. The one exception would probably be Trenton, the attack on Trenton, where he commanded one wing of the army. But then when you surprise an attack of a few hundred Hessians with your entire army, you know, that may not have been that big a deal. When he was the sole commander in the field, he would lose tactically to Lord Rawdon or to Cornwallis or to other British commanders, Major Stuart, in the various engagements. But he realized that every time he attrited the enemy in combat, even if he didn't hold the field at the end of it, then that was a strategic victory. And so that's why I say Greene was probably the most brilliant, successful strategic general on the Patriot side, certainly not one of the best tactically.
You observe throughout the book that a significant factor in any 18th century British commander's ability to project land power is his link to the sea, to British maritime superiority. Can you elaborate on that a little and discuss in a little more detail how the race to the Dan was intended to sever this link?
Sure. One of the things that when you study British military and naval history and strategic culture is you realize that it has been an emphasis on naval power really since Henry VIII in the 16th century started building up the fleet. And because of that, and also because the British Army, with certain exceptions like during the World Wars, has always been a volunteer force. Even in the 18th century, when the Continental armies, not the Continental Army, but the armies of the continent of Europe were basically peasant conscription forces, the British Army was what we call today an all-volunteer force. You enlisted for typically 7, 12, or 20 years, and that was your profession. And because of that, those soldiers tend to be very expensive and very dear. And so the British Army was always typically very, very small, very good, very professional, but very small. And it developed into what we would call an expeditionary culture, whereby you use your naval power to inject power ashore and then support them logistically. And then if you, as you had in 1809 with Sir John Moore at Corona in Spain, you had to evacuate, but then you come right back with the Duke or Lord Wellington, and then you have the whole Iberian Peninsula campaign where you had never more than 35,000 British troops on the field, and yet they attrited the French to the tune of 250,000 casualties. So that is the value of an expeditionary culture whereby you can inject power, land power, practically anywhere that you can sail a fleet into, and then you support them. Here's the problem for Cornwallis. Once they were on the coast at places like Charleston or Wilmington or Savannah, you had the benefit of naval power supporting them. But once you moved inland, chasing Nathaniel Greene, for example, you lost that connectivity with the naval support. And I think Greene realized that, and he understood that without the Royal Navy support, Cornwallis could not replace easily every man lost, whether it was by a combat wound or desertion, although by this time, very little desertion in the British Army. Anybody that was wont to desert had already gone. But he still could not replace casualties, could not replace people who died of illness. And Greene understood that. So he was willing to go on a merry chase. And the British were willing to do that. There's a great quote from Brigadier Charles O'Hara, commanded the Brigade of Guards and was Cornwallis's second in command in North Carolina. And there's a whole series of letters that O'Hara wrote. And in one of them, he says, essentially, we vow to chase Greene to the ends of the earth. And so that there's the mindset. Well, that made Cornwallis, O'Hara, whatever, all the commanders they're going to chase this guy down and beat him in action, forgetting the fact that he's pulled you inland several hundred miles into the interior of the backcountry, and there's no way that you can resupply and reinforce. So that was the power of that strategy. And actually in the book, with my thesis, if you will, under lack of command and control or loss of command and control, what I'm really talking about there is you have detached yourself from the ability to reinforce and resupply, and receive sustainment, if you will, from Clinton in New York.
One of the things too that really comes to the fore when we get to the critical race of the Dan is the power of Cornwallis's personality and his exemplary strategic leadership, if you will, in terms of inspiring the men. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. And this is one of the reasons why I so admire the guy, and was why I was so intrigued by him. Say your typical aristocratic general of the period, for example, John Burgoyne on the Saratoga campaign, his wagon trail, if you will, of personal effects was miles long. Who knows? down in marching through the wilderness down the Hudson River. Whereas Cornwallis, when on the start of the chase of Nathanael Greene in through North Carolina, they got up to Ramsour's Mill, same site as the previous battle. And at that point, he made the decision they needed to lighten up. They needed to go fast if they're going to chase Greene. And essentially a huge bonfire. They threw everything in. All they saved was, I believe, four wagons to haul wounded, a couple of wagons to haul ammunition and salt. Mm. And everything else had to be carried on their backs. Tents went in. Personal gear went in. The rum ration and the officer's wine, it all went in the bonfire, including everything of Cornwallis's. Now, that was an extraordinary thing. If you're Private Snuffy, and here's your lieutenant general, who is a peer of the realm, an earl, throwing all his personal possessions into this fire. Mm. Think about the psychological impact of that in terms of loyalty to that commander, of willingness to sacrifice for that commander. This is a reason, one of the reasons why I say very, very few desertions from that army that marched through North Carolina and into Virginia because of things like that. And he was an extraordinary, I don't want to use the word gentle, that's not really the word I'm looking at, but he was a humanitarian. He realized that given the times and given what you did with people who were treasonous, but it just, he agonized over having to execute people, and it was very rare that he would do it. One of the things that really torqued me off, if you will, about the movie that disastrous movie, The Patriot, was the portrayal of Cornwallis as this pompous, arrogant, blowhard, totally 180 degrees out from the actual character. He just, so many of his traits were those type of traits that are going to cause the men under his command to be loyal, to be faithful, to be willing to sacrifice. There was even one day on the race to the Dan where I think they covered something like 40 plus miles. Mm. Now think about this in the backcountry of North Carolina, 40 miles in a day, marching on foot, some incredible feats. Of course, the Continentals were doing the same thing, but that's I think exemplary of just the type of leadership and the devotion that the man inspired. And I think that's throughout his entire career, you see that.
Greene's Fabian strategy culminates, as you alluded to earlier, with the Battle of Guilford Courthouse. There, Cornwallis defeats Greene in a set-piece battle and then moves up into Virginia, where his campaign and the American War come to an end. In all of this, however, we tend to lose sight of the fact that Sir Henry Clinton is ensconced in New York and could have sallied forth to come to Cornwallis' aid. Did Clinton's overwhelming defensive mindset play a role in dooming Cornwallis?
Yes. Yes and no. One of the oddest things about the decision to build an operating base at Yorktown, the idea was sound. The idea was to build a defensive operating post somewhere on the Chesapeake for operations in Virginia. The way Cornwallis justified marching into Virginia. First off, think of his very aggressive personality. There was no way he was going to head back to South Carolina with his tail tucked between his legs and admit this didn't work. But he also fervently believed that the way now to defeat Nathanael Greene was to take control of the narrow neck there, really across the northern part of the Chesapeake, I guess from Delaware on through to the mountains. If you could take control of Virginia and control that and cut off all supplies and reinforcements going south, then you rely on Lord Rawdon in South Carolina to defeat Nathanael Greene, which he did and would have. That was Cornwallis's strategic intent at this point. That's why he marched into Virginia and also to join up with Phillips and the troops that had been coming down into Virginia. So that actually, when he was at Yorktown, that was the largest force he ever possessed. So that's why he went there. But then an odd thing happened. He basically said, okay, General Clinton, I'll do what you order, which he hadn't done before, and just basically build a defensive post at the one location on the entire East Coast where you could be blocked in, the York Peninsula. Now, I guess the assumption was, well, we'll build this operating base, and if we have to, we can evacuate by sea. Well, of course, then you have the loss of the Battle of the Capes to the French squadron, and essentially Chesapeake is under the control of the French Navy. So you are completely cut off there at Yorktown. I think ultimately, looking back, what he probably should have done when he realized that they had lost control of the Chesapeake, the maritime control, that's the point where he should have said, to hell with Yorktown, head towards Williamsburg again, and basically break out and operate in the field. Because if he had done that, now with 7,000 troops, there was no way that Lafayette and Anthony Wayne, who were the two commanders there at the time before Washington and Rochambeau arrived, he could have beaten both of them in detail, marched up to the northern part of the Chesapeake, and voila, Greene is cut off and isolated in South Carolina. So it's an odd sort of thing why he, as I put in the book, essentially gave up the offensive and became a garrison commander. And ultimately, that's what doomed him. Clinton had a different idea. His idea was to do operations, raids here and there in the Chesapeake. He even flirted with the idea of going back to Philadelphia. Waste of time, waste of energy and money and men. I think Cornwallis had the right idea, but here his operational execution probably broke down pretty seriously.
So in the final analysis then, was this a good strategy, poorly executed, a bad strategy, or, you know, just an impossible task?
That's the favorite question at the Naval War College we like to ask, and it's a wonderful one. I would say good strategy, badly executed. A good strategy in the sense that had it been executed differently, the assumption that the Loyalists would turn out in massive numbers, it actually could have happened. If they had not done the proclamations, that would have helped. If the Western North Carolina Loyalists under Colonel Moore had not raised too early and then got whacked at Ramseur's Mill, that was 1,300 Loyalists that would have joined the Army, and essentially I don't think Kings Mountain would have ever happened. So I would say good strategy, badly executed. You can make the argument bad strategy. I don't really buy that. Given the dynamics of what Britain was faced, in fact, there was an invasion attempt by the French and Spanish the summer of 1779. So you had to definitely worry about the home islands. You had to worry about the islands in the West Indies, which were economically hugely valuable. So you had to stretch your forces. So the idea of what can we get back that's most valuable? Well, that, of course, would have been the four or five southern colonies, again, because of the commodities. So to make that the focus of your strategy, probably a good idea. But again, you got to execute it superbly. And that they didn't do.
Are there any lessons current U.S. strategic planners, you know, and theater commanders can learn from Cornwallis's failure?
Well, this gets back to the old hearts and minds thing. And I cite in the book, there are a couple of instances where General Clinton himself actually used that phrase, and not exactly win the hearts and minds, but it's essentially what he's saying. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of letters where he does that. First, in 1776, he realized very early on that the key to winning was to maintain or keep popular support. And I think ultimately, if they had been able to do that, to fire up the loyalists to the point that they would be willing to come out in numbers and if nothing else, logistically support the army, it might have been a different dynamic. I think ultimately it probably was doomed to failure. I think the best that they might have accomplished is to win back some of the southern colonies where there probably were not overwhelming, but a majority of loyalists. And I think that's probably about the best they could do. In retrospect, though, I contend, and interestingly enough, you're going to see this in my next book, which I'm working on now, co-authoring it with some of my colleagues. And this is going to be at Routledge in their War and History series. And we're going to argue that both sides won. Of course, the United States became the United States. That's a win. But for the British Empire, it freed them from what, frankly, was an economic albatross, those colonies. There's a reason why every proprietary or privately owned colony within a few years said, that's it, turned them over to the royal government, and they became a royal colony, because it cost more money to administer and defend them than they ever made out of it. So once they were free of those colonies, the British Empire was able to focus on other places like the West Indies, the East Indies, India itself, and these areas that really built up the economy of the British Empire. So there's an argument that, yep, both sides actually won.
Would that give us then, you know, in the modern perspective, if we're thinking about, you know, you describe it beautifully in the book as a war within a war within a war.
Right.
And I think you mentioned that earlier in the interview. Should that give us pause then today, when we think about or how we assess success and failure in these, you know, in our current endeavors?
Right. And getting back to your previous question, what are the lessons learned? I hate to use that term because you can get hammered with lessons learned from the last war don't apply to this one.
Right.
But I think in this case it does. And the lesson learned is when you are engaged in a conflict at these multiple levels, the war within the war within the war, and you are having to fight at the same time a hybrid war, conventional operations, say going into Iraq and fighting the Medina division or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's a conventional war. And the United States, Great Britain, the Europeans, we got that one nailed. But what you have to understand is almost as important is what happens afterwards. I think in Iraq, we made a huge mistake by immediately de-Ba'athification and demobilizing the Iraqi army, because now all of a sudden you have these young men trained in violence, if you will, without any kind of career future. And I think, look at the problems that has created or did create and probably still is. So if you are as the planners, the decision makers, whether you're civilian or military, and you're faced with a hybrid war where you're having to win hearts and minds, if you will, but at the same time defeat conventional forces, look back at how badly the British did it in the South and take some lessons from that and apply them to your current situation. That, I think, is the big, big takeaway for us today. And unfortunately, in the last 20 years, we've learned a lot of hard lessons, again, of you might be the big dog on the street conventionally, but what happens when your victories sets in motion the partisans, the insurgents, the Francis Marions of the world, or the ISIS of the world? It's a dynamic that's going to happen over and over and over again. So as part of your strategic planning, you have to take into account that dynamic and the hearts and minds issue, and how are you going to deal with it?
Stan, you've been very generous with your time today. we kind of covered one of the last two questions we asked to all of our guests, what's your next project, which you just went through. But the last question then would be, is there anything that you're currently reading, watching, or listening to that our audience might want to check out?
Well, as you know, I was supposed to talk about at the New York Military Affairs Symposium last mm-hmm. week, which in New York got canceled.
Yeah.
So I'll do it next year, I guess. But being the 75th anniversary plus of the last couple of years of World War II, what I was going to talk about is Allied operations on the Western Front, starting with Normandy and going through basically to the Elbe River. So British and American and Free French operations. And as part of the preparation for that lecture, I'm rereading or have reread the two Cornelius Ryan great books, the one on the D-Day landing, Normandy landing, The Longest Day, and A Bridge Too Far, which is about the Operation Market Garden. And oh, by the way, both those movies, based on those books, The Longest Day and A Bridge Too Far, Hollywood got it pretty right. So I would say anybody interested in military history, even if it's not interested in World War II, I would say go back and read Cornelius Ryan, The Longest Day and A Bridge Too Far, and then go see the movies as well. That would be my recommendation.
Great. Well, Stan, thank you again for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it. And again, thanks for the opportunity to talk about my book and everything I'm working on. It's a great boon to historians for you folks like you to do that for us.
Our pleasure.
And to all of our listeners, on behalf of New Books in Military History, this is Scott Lipkowitz. Thanks for listening. Thank you.